And thank you for all the questions. It's been great, but apologies in advance if your question didn't make it onto the list, because we've got more questions than we've really got time to deal with properly. But thank you anyway, and I hope you'll understand that. But let's kick off. The first question is as follows. I've been hearing messages today about conservation, and been hearing for many years for to plant a tree in the 70s, and especially from Christians. And this can come across as a guilt trip. Is it in danger of becoming legalism? So,
this is going to be a roving mic. Would you like to start off with this one?
I don't think that legalism achieves anybody's aims. So I would hate it to become a legalistic framework that everybody ought to do X, Y, or Z. However, I do think that we need to have challenges. And if that challenge is that if you can avoid flying, do avoid it. But if you have to fly, then consider offsetting your flight by planting a tree. So if I can give a plug for a Christian offsetting organization called Climate Stewards, then I think that's a really good thing. So I think that legalism comes out of a sort of judgmental attitude. I was trying very hard this morning to say we don't need that, but that actually having targets and aims and trying to excel at this is a good thing. So calling one another up to better practices, to thinking more, is really positive.
Anybody else like to comment? Neil?
Yeah, if I can come in on that. I mean, it's a really helpful question. It seems to me that Christian responsible action to care for creation, care for our planet, is absolutely doesn't have to be legalistic. It flows from the big Christian story that Hillary outlined in her talk. So one of the things we learn from that story is that, you know, the world is not as it should be, and that's partly just because there is evil and brokenness and suffering in the world, and the ultimate origins of that are probably a mystery. But an awful lot that's wrong with the world is also to do with human sin, individual and corporate sin. We know all that. We know that our ultimate hope is not in our own hands, because we can't fix our own problems and the problems of the world simply by our own unaided efforts. But we know that our ultimate hope is secure, because it is in the God who has lived among us, died and risen again in Jesus Christ. And therefore, Christian responsibility for the created world is a matter of response to what God has done and what God has promised. It's an expression of trust in God's promises, it's an expression of hope, and it's a witness to what God promises for the ultimate healing of the world. So it's the exact opposite of legalism. It's a form of Christian witness, and it springs from the very heart of the gospel, I would say.
I was only going to add very quickly on top of that I think in this secular world at the moment there's a sense of panic and guilt, and not that we shouldn't be part of that, but I think on top of it the Christian can offer something in terms of duty and service and love and hope and responsibility that goes beyond that. Help, what on earth can we do? But this is God's world and we're part of it and we look after it.
I thought, well, something that's kind of worried me and I'm not quite sure what to do with, so this isn't so much of an opinion, it's more of a question this time. As you know, because I've just already said so, I'm very interested in schools and what's happening in schools. And we had the Friday when children were encouraged to come out of school. And I wondered how to feel about that, because I had so many different hats I could wear as I wondered this question about how to feel. So my children, we've got three children, mine are big now, so fortunately they can look after themselves. But I thought, as a parent, how would you feel? Or as a parent or as a carer, you know, if you weren't quite sure what was going to happen after you dropped your child off at school, you know, were they actually going to stay in there or were they going to come out? And then as a teacher, how would you feel if you got to the classroom and you only had three in there? And what would you say to the three who were left? Were they doing the right thing by being in your classroom or the wrong thing by not getting out there and campaigning? So I think these questions, which have not necessarily had a lot of attention until recently, are starting to get a lot of attention. And so, as I've said already earlier on, I think it's definitely an opportunity for coming through with guidance, because people are looking for guidance and what to say. We even had the adverts, didn't we? Did anybody see the adverts with the reading the little girl the story at bedtime, in which the planet was basically, you know, on its last legs? So, you know, how do we respond to children who suddenly have the weight of these big questions upon them, and yet the power that they have to do something, in my view, is quite a dangerous power. If what we're talking about is saying to the young person, well, you don't need to be at school now, you could be somewhere else. So, as I say, I think it's an opportunity to be in there trying to think about these questions.
Okay. Thanks. Okay, if you hold on to that, John, because there's a question coming up for you to start off with. I'm just going to lay down a marker here. I'm not going to let every one of the panel answer every question, otherwise some people might miss their train. Okay. So don't be offended if I cut you off. So, John, a question here says that communication of scientific discoveries to the general public does not take place in a neutral environment. Vested interests, mostly financial, seek to create doubt or distort findings that may harm their interests. Do we educate scientists and the public sufficiently about this context?
Well, the simple answer is no.
Next.
it does go back to the schools issue, actually, I think, about what schools now still have debates, for instance, about key issues, where you have people on various sides, because these are normally complex issues. They're not black or white at all, and actually seeing what all the nuances are and building on that. So I'll start with that. I also think, too, we are going through an information revolution as we move away from newspapers and traditional forms of communication, post-truth and all the rest of it. And so, therefore, I think we do have to teach people how to critique what's going on. They don't necessarily have to understand the science. In fact, a lot of it I don't understand. In fact, the most of it I don't understand. But I do know how to look at it and to critique it. So I think it's the technique of being able to analyse and debate, and also to hold ideas which you aren't sure about in the cloud, as it were, before coming to. I was just talking to somebody earlier about, I actually think data literacy ought to be taught in primary schools, so that when you get to university, there's loads and loads of MSc courses and diploma courses in data science going on at the moment. It's estimated we need 500,000 data scientists by 2025 in the whole of Europe, and there are hardly any at the moment. So there's a catch-up mode, but surely we should be doing it. And one of the things I thought of is that one could actually, in primary schools, and I'm trying to persuade the European Commission to do this, is to link primary schools in different parts of Europe to start discussing some of these things. So you've got the cultural differences as well as the information differences. So that, yeah. But the answer was no.
Well, perhaps I could ask Keith to come in, because it seems to me a lot of the issues around and public trust in science relate to the pharmaceutical industry in particular, and various testing procedures that are done on drugs and the costing of drugs and so on. And people get mixed messages about different vaccines. How do we educate people, both scientists, to communicate whatever sufficient truth they have and the public to receive it?
I think we need to be educating scientists to use words carefully, so that when we use the words risk, as a scientist, is a very technical word, the general public does not hear the word risk and thinks this is dangerous, whereas actually for a scientist, it says we can only be 99% sure. There are other ways in which we might give the impression of certainty, when actually quite the opposite is true, is this is an opinion. So I think training scientists to be careful. I think there is the other side of it. No matter how careful the scientist is, the media will nearly always misrepresent it. And that says, I think, we need more scientists in the media. Science correspondents who really do understand the science rather than just understand journalism.
Yes. Okay. I mean, our debates with other parts of society are plagued by that word problem as well, because some people think a theory, which we use as scientists, has a different meaning from a theory that comes up in a crime novel, as it were, that people use the word theory in different senses.
Oh, absolutely. In terms of the philosophy of science, we need to get that across, where people think that theory means a hunch that I had after breakfast this morning, whereas actually theory is at the top of the scientific paradigm, so something that's well reinforced by lots and lots of data, which is totally different to what the general public perceive as theory.
I completely agree with you, and as you know, I listen when I'm listening to the radio, and there's a scientist who is embedding philosophy of science into the way that they're presenting their ideas and what they've found out. It's just bliss. It's fantastic, and I hope that all the teachers and all the children are listening, because it's so helpful. I think you're completely right. I think one of the things that's happened is the route that many people go through in order to then become scientists means that they haven't had philosophy of science necessarily, and so they are missing that language, and then their thoughts, whenever they are in the media, are just on their peers as they understand them, and in trying to sort of say things that will appeal to that audience, make sure that, you know, they haven't said the wrong thing in front of their colleagues, as it were. Make sure you've mentioned the funder, if that's what you're meant to have done, you know, all these sorts of pressing anxieties that one might have. And yeah, I completely agree. I think having the opportunity to step back and embed that language of philosophy of science when scientists are talking is brilliant.
Okay. So I'm going to merge two questions here. I hope you'll see the connection. The first question is to ask whether Christians have a role in demystifying science or of maintaining its integrity. And the related question is, how does one expose the apparent arrogance of science without destroying respect for its usefulness? Okay, Barry, you might need to kick off on that one.
There you are. Well, that's it. I won't need to take up any more time. Sufficient truth. I think it's brilliant, don't you? Is it just such a great phrase, you know? Where was that when we were all at school? It was nowhere, was it? It just needs to be there. These sorts of terms need to be embedded into the language, and then they'll be more available to people.
Well, thank you, Barry. I won't tell you how it came about. I came up with that phrase, but now my daughter's left. I can probably tell you, because when they were, my daughter's just left. My children were at school, and they decided to do science. And when they were at school, they said to me when they were doing GCSE, shut up, Deb, we don't want to discuss science, really. We've got to answer these questions, you know. And that was, you know, so we had school science and sufficient science, you know, sufficiently true science. So that's where it all came from, although Mary would probably disown me now if I said it. But I think the concept of arrogance is actually something that has to be overcome. I mean, I had words humility in my mind when I'm not humble, but my mind about when I was speaking earlier, because if we are uncertain about things, we should be admitting some of that. But on the other hand, you don't want to be so taking the everything away, the carpet from underneath people, otherwise you don't get it, get anywhere. And so there, I think there is a sort of Christian humility in science that perhaps we need to explore a lot more.
Right, okay. A question directly first to Neil, if I may. Which goes as follows. Given the diversity of religions, and for the questioner, as a Christian, all the other ones being wrong, how can I take seriously any scientific study of religion or religious experience?
Right. I think the first thing I would want to say is that Christians ought to be a little bit wary about saying all the others are wrong. And my reason for wanting to say that goes back to one of the people I had up on my slides, Karl Barth, because he's going to be absolutely positive that we can only truly know God as God reveals God's self to us, and for Barth that's centrally in the person of Jesus Christ, to whom the Scriptures witness. So he's going to make a very strong claim for the Christian revelation. But God is free to reveal God's self wherever and however God chooses. So it's not really for us to say where truth about God may or may not be found in the world. So I think we need to be a little bit cautious about saying our faith is right and everybody else is wrong. We can get things wrong because, you know, we do our theology, you know, wrongly, as someone like Barth would say. We build our own idolatrous images of God in the name of Christianity, in the name of Christian faith, and we need correcting. It's Christianly imaginable, at least, that God reveals God's self through other faith traditions. That's opening up a very, you know, very, very big question that we don't have time to go into in any sort of depth this afternoon. But I want to sound a cautionary note about that. But the question was, how can we have any sort of confidence in scientific studies of religion in general, that make generalized claims about religion? I have a great deal of sympathy with the criticism that lies behind that question. I think one of the real problems with a lot of the kind of scientific studies that I was talking about, and scientific approaches I was talking about this morning, is that they have this sort of generalized construct called religion, or sometimes supernatural beliefs, or something like that. They assume that there's this one thing called religion, and Christianity and Judaism and Islam and Hinduism and so on are sort of species of that. And it all basically works in the same way, and you can you can work out how it works scientifically. And to someone who inhabits a particular tradition of faith, and, you know, to us as people who inhabit a Christian tradition of faith, that is very likely to be quite a wrong-headed way to think about this whole thing. That's one of the basic things that I think is wrong with the neurotheology approach I was talking about. The notion that you can invent some general rules for how all, you know, theologies and religions work. Christian faith and theology starts from somewhere particular, God who is revealed in Jesus Christ. So making generalized claims about, you know, that are supposed to apply to you know, supernatural beliefs in general is potentially a distorted way of framing the whole inquiry from the start. So one of the things I could have said more firmly in when I was talking about this stuff this morning is you need to have some fairly strong caveats in your mind and a fairly critical sort of attitude when you're evaluating these scientific claims from the perspective of Christian faith. That's probably the caveat that's assumed in quite a lot of what I was then going on to say about it.
Anybody else like to comment that, or have a follow-up question on related to you, Neil, I'm afraid, so you don't get off that easily. If neuroscience cannot explain consciousness, surely it's folly to attempt to reduce a complex concept such as God, which has little, if any, direct perception in the natural world. And in other words, can physics ever explain metaphysics?
Well, the short answer to that is no. I think that's a point that's very often forgotten or not properly appreciated when we try and set up dialogues or encounters between science and faith. Because One of the things that's very easy to forget is that science, the sciences are very particular ways of structuring and gathering knowledge. They do a particular job and they do it extraordinarily well, but it's very easy, because they do that particular kind of job so well, it's very easy to fall into the trap of thinking that's the only kind of job that there is to be done. That's the basic mistake that Richard Dawkins makes. He essentially thinks scientific knowledge is the only kind of knowledge that really counts as knowledge. And it's very easy for Christians who are attempting to set up a more constructive sort of engagement with science to fall into a very similar way of thinking, and therefore to imagine that that you have to try and think about faith in the same basic way that you think about science. And that seems to me to be a fundamental mistake. I could say more about that, but I won't.
I just wanted to point out, isn't it brilliant, you see, because then that's where you're doing the relating science and religion. Isn't it interesting that once you start to try to relate science and religion, you start to say some really useful things about science, like it's a particular way of structuring how we're going about finding out ideas and testing them. You start to say those sorts of things to make a distinction between the types of questions that science is good at addressing, and it does its job well. And as I say, that is so missing for young people, because they're not relating science and religion that way. They're just seeing them as separate classrooms that some children call rival classrooms. Mm-hmm. Say again?
Was that a heckle or a question?
Somebody coughing? Coming from outside. Yeah, and I was also only going to say, the other person I'm going to deliberately mention and plug, because I've already mentioned John Wood here, is also Mike Poole, who's here, because he got me started with all of these sorts of ideas. And I did my PhD in Australia, and I was looking at how university students think about science and religion. And his book was one of the books that was on the shelf. And he's just given me another copy of it now, which is brilliant, because I said I don't have enough copies of it. So, you know, I just want to, as I keep saying, I just want to encourage those of us, because now hopefully I'm one of them, who are encouraging young people to ask those questions and think about those relationships, because it's a way of thinking about science that is missing for young people that I think would help them with a lot of these other challenges that they're facing at the moment.
Right. I mean, it's related to the question about whether physics underlies everything is one of the most fundamental issues in science and faith, it seems to me, and that the materialist or naturalist attack on religion is based on a reductionist method of thinking that ultimately takes you down to atoms or fundamental particles. And if that's all there is, then reason itself is invalidated, because it's just what atoms are doing, and the concepts of truth and justice and fairness and the things that we value just disappear as epiphenomena. So I always like to challenge people who put that argument to me, that if they take their argument to its logical conclusion, then what they've just said is nonsense.
We had 300 students on campus, and they are raving over this, and that's all it does. It just says that.
Yes.
It just exactly says that. Yeah. It says that science doesn't, although that reductionism is a tool we use in science, it's methodological reductionism and not metaphysical reductionism. In other words, exactly like you say, it's a way of testing a small question and of reducing in order to see if it makes more sense when we make it smaller. I've always said one of the brilliant conspiracies we do with school children as well is we tell them how to do an experiment in the primary science classroom, and you're experimenting on, let's say, a piece of spaghetti. So all the human beings around the outside, so they're not in the experiment. So the children are seeing science answer a question that's very amenable to science: how much weight breaks the piece of spaghetti? They love it, very hands-on and all the rest of it. Nobody ever says to them, well, we took the people out when we described nature working in this way. So then it's not surprising if the children think that science assumes that the people are in that very reductive description. In other words, if you can reduce a piece of spaghetti to, you know, an equation and something that you've measured with a force meter, then you have to remind children that actually we reduced the question in order to be able to answer it in science. But if we step back it all becomes a lot more complicated again. And I think we forget to say that to children. They assume that what they saw happen with the spaghetti is what science is telling them is true of them too.
Right. Okay, here's a question for Hilary. It's quite a long question. Given the huge injustices and environmental problems associated with animal agriculture, for example, deforestation and plastic waste produced by the fishing industry, greenhouse gas emissions from animal industries, etc., etc., and the amount of suffering experienced by farm animals, would you say it's right for Christians to continue supporting this industry through our consumption of animal products such as meat, eggs, and dairy? So how far do we take that, Hilary?
Okay, well, I'll put my hands up and say, I said earlier this morning I was vegetarian, but I am moving more towards a plant-based diet for some of the reasons that that question outlines. Now, I don't want to, I'm not trying to be legalistic or judgmental about that. I do think we do all need to think about where our food comes from. And I mean, the question is talking about justice and animal welfare. I do think we need to think about the kind of meat we're eating if we're meat eaters, because you can get to your, you know, £2.50 chicken from Tesco's or wherever and know that it's not had
a happy life,
to put it, you know, blandly. Or you can choose to say, yes, I want to still eat chicken. My husband still wants to eat chicken. He's actually cooking a roast chicken as we speak, but it is an organic free-range chicken. It cost me a lot of money. And there is another issue actually to do with, you know, is this people's income streams and so on. But, you know, for all of us in the room, if we choose to eat meat and can only therefore afford to eat meat once a week instead of every day, I would say that's a win, you know, because actually we're fulfilling what I would say is a biblical injunction to think about the welfare of the animals that we farm, and that's, you know, Deuteronomy advocates a farmer taking care of his animals, but at the same time we're perhaps recognizing the economic strains of doing so in this day and age. I have to say, I think it's iniquitous that food has become so cheap. I mean, you might think it's great that you don't have to spend so much on food, but actually when I was growing up, meat particularly was so much more expensive as a proportion of my parents' rather meager income, that we ate much less of it. We were much more careful about, you know, the kind of occasions we ate meat. So I think that that's the kind of thinking I would encourage people to have. And then also to think about whether actually it is right to become more, you know, to give up meat altogether, and but certainly think about where it comes from. Think about the fish you buy and where it comes from. Don't know if anybody else has been on a journey with this.
Yeah, if I can just come in on that briefly, and maybe stir up a bit of controversy by going a little bit further or putting it more strongly than Hilary has. It seems to me that there are good reasons for most Christians in the West, let me put it like that anyway, to adopt a vegan diet or as close to it as they can manage. Some of those reasons are environmental. More compellingly for me, it's a matter of valuing all of God's creatures and creating conditions in which all of God's creatures can flourish as the kinds of creatures they are. The author I would heartily recommend as a wise person to read on this is the theologian David Clough, who's based at the University of Chester, who's written a two-volume work called On Animals, which to my mind is the definitive work on animal theology and ethics now and for some time to come. He makes this kind of case very strongly.
So. Okay, thanks. I have to confess, my wife, through the influence of my daughter, is pushing me to become a vegan. And I do warn you that your digestive systems take a lot of adjustment to make. But it's probably worth doing. I'm still on that journey.
I would say it's the opposite is true. My digestive system has never been better since I stopped eating dairy. Yes. So
it's just a transition. Keith?
Yeah. I'll put a slightly contrary view. As a committed omnivore, but one who is being more aware of the sorts of things I eat and the distance that it is travelled, and the condition that it's been kept in. I think the basic biochemistry, to me, says that a vegan diet by itself is not sufficient because there are vitamin deficiencies in a vegan diet. I think we are made to be more than that, but I think we are made to be utterly responsible for what we eat. And there are, and actually doing the equations of actually what's the land use in terms of a vegan diet as compared to an omnivorous diet. And I don't have the answers to those questions. But I think, personally, as one who's trying to reduce the amount of high consumption meat, you know, the beef particularly, I think it is important that we all give some considerable thought to that. But I wouldn't want to personally go down a line that says you have to be a vegan or a vegetarian.
Just hold on to the microphone, Keith, because I have another question for you of slightly more technical nature. If our genetic makeup, knit in the womb as it were, informs at least to some extent who we are there genes which give the propensity to believe in God?
There was an awful book published in 2002 called The God Gene by Dean Hamer, which purported to suggest that there was something in the noradrenaline storage system that purported that people were more likely to, I forget the phrase, but it was to be spiritual in one way or the other. That sort of study is actually complete nonsense, and it's never been reported in the scientific literature. If we are going to equate belief in God with some form of personality trait, then yes, there may be genetic influences on that. But belief in God, I think, goes far beyond personality. Now, there are those who are very, if you like, robust and forceful in personality who are firm believers. And there are those who are, I don't know, touchy-feely types. And yet belief in God goes beyond any of those things. And I think our genetics may influence our personality, but the personality and the belief in God are totally different. There's not a gene for being a dupe and being persuaded of unbelievable things. There may be a whole lot of genetics that comes together to say we're a different kind of a person. But if belief in God is a matter of truth, then I don't think that there's a genetic element to whether something is true or not.
Okay, perhaps we'll finish up on a more general question, which asks that Plato thought that knowledge was more fundamental than opinion or belief, and he's picking up the quotation from Einstein in the earlier talk. Whilst I respect Einstein's contribution to science, surely imagination cannot be more important than pure knowledge in the Socratic sense. I can imagine a unicorn, but that does not mean it exists. So will the person who used that Einstein quotation please own up and answer this question?
This goes back to really quite a fundamental thing. It goes back to your reductionism in my mind, that if knowledge is just about factual things, then frankly being human is a waste of time. And therefore, to have the imagination, even if it's not possibly true. I mean, one of the things we're doing at CERN, and I was mentioning it to Keith earlier, is that we're inviting a load of science fiction writers to come and join us to help us think beyond where we're at the moment. Because it turns out, and I didn't know this, but we had a bunch of philosophers at CERN a year or so ago, that a lot of the early work of NASA was based on somebody who had visions, a lady in the 1890s, and it enabled the NASA scientists to think beyond what they were thinking of. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I think knowledge is important, I just think it's much more important to have a vision, because without a vision, the people perish.
Keith?
Imagination is fundamental to human existence and to science, but I think imagination without knowledge is fantasy. And pure daydreaming. And that's why I want to put some form of element of caution on a few things that have been said, is that there has to be, I think, there has to be a foundation of knowledge to enable you to be able to dream and imagine. And with that, just the dreaming by itself doesn't get us anywhere.
Yes. Hilary's got a comment. Oh, sorry, Neil.
I just want to add, I agree very much with what John and Keith have said. I just want to add the other side of this imagination and knowledge kind of binary. We ought to be a little bit more critical and self-critical about what we imagine knowledge to be and how cut and dried our knowledge is. Knowledge is a funny business and more complex than we often take it to be.
Final comment, Barry?
Oh. Do you want
one? Okay. Last word.
Okay. Oh, well, I don't know if that's a good idea or not, really. Well, I'm interested that you said you're taking science fiction writers to CERN, because it's actually struck me quite often that if you... I don't read a lot of science fiction, but science fiction seems to be the precursor of quite a lot of science. And I don't think it's a direct causal link, but, you know, science fiction was what... talk to us about life on other planets, imagined finding aliens and so on. And you know, now the search for life on other planets has become a scientific enterprise. I'm not saying a causal relationship that the science fiction has fed that, but it's the imagination of those science fiction writers, which, as you say, to go beyond, is already kind of something that you can see science is then taking one step further.
I think everybody said everything that's good already. Right, just block your ears, because I'm going to waffle for a second. Well, I was going to say that I think in the stuff that we've produced for schools and where we're going with it for schools, there is that notion, isn't there, that, you know, in answering that question, it's then what is the next question and where does it go from here? And I talked already about that zooming out and zooming in. So knowledge is when you zoom in, isn't it? So knowledge is when you zoom in and here's what we've already done and here's what we found out. And if you do this again, you'll find this out again, we hope. And then as you zoom out, you come back to the uncertainty and the areas where you start to think, well, you know, how does this link with that? Or what's the next question? So I think the imagination, a bit like you've already said, really, is brilliant, because it's the bit that gets you to go the next step, isn't it? So it's not knowledge without imagination, and it's not imagination without knowledge. What's really interesting is that relationship between them, isn't it?
Yeah, I think someone once said that the failure to have faith is a failure of the imagination. You know, to move from the evidence that we have for our faith to put our trust in something is a failure of imagination to see what it would be like and to make that commitment.
More interesting and profound to say now, which is to quote John Polkinghorne, because he does that fantastic thing. He talks about kettles. He's got a big thing about kettles. They come up a fair bit, because he's got his usual one that most people quote about why is the kettle hot, and it's because it's tea, and it's also because it's got an element. But he's got another kettle analogy, which is to think about miracles. And he says, if you only ever saw water getting to 60 degrees and you thought you knew everything there was to know about water on the basis of what you've seen happen up to 60 degrees, and then one day you saw a kettle boiling, but you could never get it to do it again, because you could never get water above 60 degrees again, then you would have seen something that looks like a miracle. So it's that notion that there's always something more that we haven't yet found out, which you also had in your quotes, didn't you, as well? There we go.
Well, let's thank our panelists again. Thank you very much.